Hello everybody, welcome to the second episode of season 4 of Blockchain Won't Save the World, and I'm very happy to be joined by Nick Musalem. He's the head of product for Ava Labs, and we're going to be talking about something that I think is massively important for the wider adoption of blockchain and decentralized web. We're going to be talking about blockchain as a service, and specifically Ava Cloud. Nick, how are you doing today?
Excellent, thanks for having me, Anthony.
My absolute pleasure. Big fan of Avalanche, really interested to hear more about what you guys at Ava Labs have been doing. But for those people who don't know you, could you give us a quick introduction?
Yeah, for sure. Nick Musalem, head of product at Ava Labs. Started my crypto journey 2016, 2017 as a trader. Previous to this life, I built institutional financial software for buy-side, sell-side traders. And one of my good friends that we used to go out to lunch when I was living in Japan and working there, he was very into trying to arb Bitcoin prices across the different centralized exchanges. And so that kind of led me down the rabbit hole. And then we built kind of an EMS system for crypto on top of the stuff we were building. And that kind of just opened the can of worms. And so co-founded a crypto hedge fund in 2019 and really offering crypto to crypto solutions to traditional wealth managers so they didn't have to worry about all the setup and kind of using Silvergate and their SEN network very early on. One was a Bitcoin alpha fund. Second one was a inflation adjusted market cap weighted index. And so they could just offer these to their clients. And then it started to get into, these used to take cash positions at certain times. They were smart beta products and got it into earning with Compound, which was just coming around with Uniswap around that time. And so that kind of flipped the lid for me. And then I went all the way in and just thought, wow, if we can do this with financial stuff, we can probably do a lot of this for anything that needs some kind of middle settlement layer. And exited that and then did a bunch of research and had the good fortune of meeting Emin and Kevin and joined Ava Labs right before their mainnet launch in 2020.
There we go. So somebody who's come from a little bit of degen, a little bit of deep transformation and a detailed, very detailed, very granular understanding of digital assets, which I think in this space increasingly is very important. I would be amiss if I didn't ask, how are you feeling about the launch of the Bitcoin ETF in the US? Do you feel like this is a positive move in general? Is this just proving what you knew all along? How are you feeling about it?
Yeah, I think it really supports the digital store value narrative and it opens up and exposes it to a much wider audience that now no longer need to think about wallets and keys and securing their own crypto and have a really easy avenue to be able to access Bitcoin as an alternative investment vehicle to round out their portfolio. So I think I'm very happy about it. I think the more people that are using and learning about it, the more people that will understand it and then also generate new uses for it or maybe demand more from it in ways that we haven't thought about yet. So the more, the merrier for sure.
Sounds good. Sounds positive. Nick, let's get into it. You mentioned Ava Labs, Avalanche. You've been there for a number of years, but not everybody understands the Avalanche story. So just to help baseline a little bit, could you give us a couple of minutes on Avalanche as a blockchain? What's particularly unique and what do people need to know about it?
Yeah, definitely. It's a very interesting story and it's had this really nice evolution that continues on to this day. So it really started with our CEO, Dr. Emin Gunsir and Kevin Siknicki and Ted Yin coming together to put some very novel ideas around unique consensus mechanisms together. And they had this idea where they were using gossip protocols to get sub-second finality on the blockchain, which at that time was completely unheard of. I think you had Bitcoin and Ethereum. And it takes a long time and it didn't really feel snappy or like a Web 2 experience. And so that was the very first piece that they did. And they have that consensus, those consensus mechanisms embedded into various types of VMs. And it's a three-chain model. And that three-chain model is also very important because the C chain is an EVM-based chain, supports Solidity, supports smart contracts, feels a lot like Ethereum, just much faster, much cheaper at the time. But then there's the concept of the P chain, which is really an administration chain that allows for something called subnets. And subnets was the second very novel idea And where, say, as Bitcoin was single coin on a single chain and Ethereum was single chain with many coins, Avalanche was really many chains, many coins, or many tokens, right? And so that was the change there. And so it offers this horizontally scaling mechanism where that didn't really exist before. And it's been very successful. I think the closest you get to it is the world of Polkadot that was existing in Cosmos at that time, which are both very viable solutions solving the same problem. And then now it keeps getting more interesting because I think we have a very strong engineering team, and that engineering team is constantly driving the wave of innovation. And in the last year, everybody's been very heads down on a few different initiatives. The first one is warp messaging. So warp messaging is using BLS signatures to enable interoperability between all these horizontally scaling subnets, and so that they can talk to each other seamlessly. And the idea is that you don't even know what blockchain you're on anymore. You're just doing what you want to do. The technology falls into the background. And then there's some things that sit on top of that, teleporters and EVM implementation that allows for interoperability, but you can interoperate between any chains. And then I think getting into the fourth area, which we're working on that will come up this year as well, is the Hyper-VM, the Hyper-SDK, Patrick and Steven and team have been working on. And so then the novel idea there is that Avalanche just isn't an EVM chain. It supports multiple VMs. And so we have other teams that are porting the Move VM on. And so it really gives a lot of optionality for builders to figure out what they want to do and how they want to scale. So if you have this horizontal scaling mechanism, then you have these parallel transaction models that allow us to really scale throughput vertically. And you have this very kind of powerful mixture that, again, starts to take the limitations of the technology away from so much of the story and really focuses on the use cases that are deploying on them. And then the last piece probably would be that kind of distribution deployment mechanism, which is AvaCloud, which is really taking the need for a lot of deep technical knowledge about how blockchain and infrastructure works and really offering a no-code solution to be able to launch your own blockchain in a matter of minutes for essentially free in that dev tier and really understand the power of what's going on before having to take it. Before it was like, there were studies that came out that says it takes a year and $1.5 million to launch your own blockchain, and those days are gone.
Very interesting. A really unsurprisingly precise and concise description from someone with head of product in their title. So I appreciate you probably done that a few times, but I'm hearing fast, I'm hearing EVM compatible, I'm hearing subnets, which is important for kind of private networks, but also different VMs or different types of chain activity. I'm hearing cross-chain or cross-subnet messaging. I'm previously of Polkadot persuasion, so that feels familiar to me and is super important in a trustless manner, and also have a cloud, and we are going to get onto that. I did want to give a quick shout out to the people in the comments as well, though. We have got people from all around the world listening in. I'm seeing Istanbul, I'm seeing Dallas, Texas, Africa. Shout out Peter in Lake Tahoe. Carolyn, I see you. Thank you so much, everybody, for dialing in and giving us your GMs. And we've already got some questions coming in about ERC standards and various other things. So we've got some more to get into later on, but let's get to the crux of the show. Blockchain as a service, the ability to spin up blockchain capabilities, blockchain technology, be able to have enterprises, governments, any builder access decentralized technology in an easy way. One of the challenges, or many of the challenges that I see today, is that even if you come to basic enterprise software, very few enterprises roll their own anymore. You don't see companies building their own access databases with macros and a whole bunch of other complex functionality built on top. Banks probably still run on COBOL in different corners of the world. Shout out to the COBOL developers, but still they're probably consuming some sort of banking as a service, CRM as a service, e-commerce as a service. And now we're getting into the same thing with blockchain. Tell us the origin story of AvaCloud. How did you get to this point? And what's the importance? What are the features that you're looking at this point in time?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. So subnets, that stuff was all built into the original white paper. So there was a tremendous amount of foresight by the founders and what they wanted the vision to be. And it was realized pretty quickly. I think it was towards the end of 2021 where the engineering team was able to offer these out and started to publicize them and dev channels. And there was a lot of people tinkering with it, but as a product person, you're like, this is amazing. It's revolutionary. It's going to allow everything to just explode. And then there's got to be something more. Like, we're missing something here. And so we went out and talked to people. And after a long series of conversations, the common thread we heard was just like, we don't want to be blockchain infrastructure experts. We don't. And it's not a very similar skill set to say DevOps or infra for Web 2, right? The decentralized network, the node architecture, RPC endpoints, validators, all a new and novel way of thinking about how to run distributed systems. Maybe not new, but new for a lot of people. And so we went back to the drawing board and said, how do we make it easy for people to launch these? What would be a perfect world example of that? And then we went back and talked to the teams, and there was a few internal hackathons, and Connor Daly and a talented bunch put together an initial version of Ava Cloud over kind of a two-day period that made us realize, yes, this is very possible. And not only can we launch this kind of this managed blockchain service that allows teams to rapidly build, deploy, and scale these decentralized networks, kind of customized for any use case, like literally in minutes, that was it. That's when we were like, okay, this is definitely the route we need to go. And it just keeps scaling on because we get the basic of Ava Cloud, which is the chain architecture, validators, RPC endpoints, data ingestion, API delivery, all the core components of it. And then it keeps adding on. It's, oh, we need gas relayers because we don't want the users to be interfacing with gas and transactions like that. Or we need account abstraction, or we need to accept credit cards and start blending the two worlds together. And so as you go through it as a product person, it's just like the roadmap's exciting because it's bound, it's endless. And we have a studios team who's essentially a professional services team that works with every single client that's launching Ava Cloud. And so we get this very clear signal back on what it is that clients want and what they're asking for. And so we're leaving the point where we have to use a lot of gut decision-making to figure out what they want. And we're really just listening to the client base now and trying to serve them as best we can. So that's the origin story and where we are right now.
Love that. And again, you can see the pain point, right? The more things that an IT function has to manage, probably the less appealing it becomes in the modern day. I think you, in that regard, lose some of the craft that sits within an IT function, but at the same time, they've now got an increasing number of other things that they have to manage in terms of data governance, in terms of compliance with a whole bunch of other different specific requirements, regulations. The role of IT today is only getting harder. And so the less things that a DevOps or a systems administrator or an application manager has to manage, frankly, the better, because they're juggling so many other things at once. We would like them to step out into emerging technology, but like you said, it's a depart. It's an unfamiliar architecture. There are components of this that they're not familiar with managing and running or configuring. It's probably there's already enough barriers at just that point to say, no, not ISO compliant or not able to be consumed as an API. Just no. If I can't take it with low code integration, I'm not going to, because that's just too complicated.
Yeah, totally. It's an interesting point that you bring up, because the other thing was that the IT people and the key decision makers, a lot of them weren't sure they wanted to make a commitment to blockchain, right? They have these centers of innovation inside their enterprises. They're looking to them and saying, show us the real world value here. And if you come back and say, listen, this is a tremendously complex and expensive area, that kind of turns them away right now because there's reputational risk. And so a lot of what Ava Cloud is doing is de-risking the decision-making process for those people, which is you can launch it in minutes and it's free and you can test everything out. Or even the test nets and the main nets, it's a day at most to get it launched so that you can start to work. And then we're building these integration tiers on top with partners like ThirdWeb that allow you to drop in and start to fill up the application layer with smart contracts that have been audited. So we're trying to de-risk the entire process all the way through to change the perception and make the decision-making process a lot less scary so that people can go out and try and then realize the power of the technology for their own use cases and then push that forward for greater adoption.
I like that. And mentioning we're going higher up the stack, there have been chain and node as a service capabilities for a number of years now. The likes of Kaleido or Blockdaemon do similar. And so you're able to spin up an environment, connect to an environment that's hosted for you that does direct node connection to the blockchain as opposed to light nodes. You have wallets and custody that's able to come with that. Again, these are things that are blockchain specific, but they're not necessarily value adding to the organization that wants to use decentralized technology, but doesn't want additional admin. So we're already taking that away, which is a good thing. You started to mention the application stack, and this is the bit that I find super interesting, because I think that there's a space between blockchain as a service, pure infrastructure, and software as a service, which has blockchain infrastructure underneath it, that I think probably is somewhere on the roadmap. It's saying that you would like whoever is building e-commerce solutions, whoever is building finance and digital asset tokenization solutions, whoever's building gaming solutions, to have Avalanche plugged underneath. And that's more of an integration story with their workflows and their software, rather than giving infrastructure that somebody can build their own dApps on. Where are you guys on that spectrum at the moment?
So we're at the end of the day, we're enablers. We're just a catalyst for people to realize whatever their technology vision is. And that technology, the technology itself, like everything that Avalanche has built, the foundation, all the open source stuff, it's meant to be incredibly flexible to meet whatever the use case you want to do it with. We've needed to build a lot of our own tooling, and you can look to our own core wallet as an example, where we went out and said to other wallet providers and said, hey, we want to support this model, this multi-VM, multi-chain world. And once we got out of the EVM conversation, it got less easy for them to accommodate. And so we realized that we needed to build our own wallet to be able to ensure that every single custom blockchain that was launched would be guaranteed a very sound and functional and user-friendly wallet application to guide it. And so that's a model that we keep using, which is, where are the friction points that are keeping us from getting that mass adoption? And how do we address them in a way that provides utility, not for one sector, but for everyone? Subnets are public, they're private, they're semi-private. You can create consortiums, you can really organize them however you want. And that really serves more traditional internet company and government and institutional finance use cases. Whereas if you want to go really full crypto native, which we've seen a ton of, that's there for you to do. And you can go from private to public as a part of that process. And so those are that's the kind of utility, and that's where we sit. It's really, like I said earlier, we're really trying to get the technology into the background so that it's just there and it works. And then we're focusing on the applications that are built on top, because we use this flywheel internally. And the first step of that flywheel really is, number one, facilitate the easy deployment of Web3 applications. And so a lot of people focus on the user, how are we going to acquire users? And so that's like our fourth step, which is like first step number one, make it so people can deploy. And the thinking is, if it's easy to deploy, then that'll lead to increased application deployments, more developer involvement, more unique use cases that are disparate in what they're doing, solving real world problems. And once you start to serve real world problems for various sectors, niche, whatever it is, then the users will come on board and you'll start to get them. And then you'll start to get that product market fit. And then of course, they're going to say, I want more. I want to do this and this. And then you just get into this nice perpetual wheel. And so that's where our thinking starts.
And it's a helpful description for other people listening in, because this is the challenge of the universal layer one protocol that can be applied to literally anything, anywhere, all the time. You can go into some very specific solutions that serve specific industries, but if it's not reusable, you can burn a whole bunch of development cycles on something that's very specific. And this is where having an ecosystem helps, is that maybe you don't do all of the development or all of the functionality, but if you don't get those primitives, the base level capability, it's going to be harder for other people to then go and serve those other industries on top. And then once you've got those bits of middleware, you can start creating decentralized applications that can attract users, which is step four.
Exactly. You know,
buy underpants and step four, get users. Yeah. Let's get a bit more tangible for people, because you started to mention some use cases or started to mention specific examples. What are the use cases that you're most excited about with AvaCloud, or what are the ones that bring the story to life most tangibly for people?
Yeah, so I think there's probably three core sectors that have been fast to adopt, get the technology, understand where the value is for there specifically. Gaming always typically leads. It's forward thinking what it's doing. It's always looking to differentiate. And so for them, it's like when you get into the Y blockchain, you have companies like Shrapnel, whose game is amazing, and the underlying technology they're building to support other gamers and other development gaming is going to just further enhance and accelerate adoption. For them, it's okay, we need to reward our players. And so now you're rewarding through NFT-based ownership. And so they're actually getting true ownership of in-game assets that are then tradable on a secondary market. And so instead of getting something that's maybe worthwhile and has value inside the game itself, now you have something, especially with subnets where everything's just digital, can be traded across multiple games. It's empowering the creators because they can add their own skins and maps and what other in-game assets they're doing, and then put those in, and then they can receive rewards for doing that. And then these player-owned economies are just going to ultimately start to create additional streams of revenue, which, you know, continually will drive the gaming industry more and more into Web3. And so that's what we're seeing there. And subnets are pretty interesting for gaming too, because if you're a game publisher and you are constantly launching new games, you're having to rebuild a lot of the infrastructure for every game launch. Whereas if you have your own subnet, say your own native token, then you basically are using the same underlying economics and you're transferring value from game to game. You're not having to rebuild all that infrastructure. And so as the kind of game, like the game launch curve where you start to get adoption, it gets a lot of growth, and then it starts to wane, then you can launch the next game on top of it, and you don't really need to start from scratch. So there's these economies of scale for game publishers to be able to move more quickly and how they go about deployment and really mixing those two games together. So, you know, gaming is leading in a lot of ways on this front with those use cases.
I really like that one. And Shrapnel's one that I've been following that for probably a couple of years now. It was probably the first L1 conceived AAA game that we saw in Web3 that wasn't just simple make tokens equals game. And so you actually had tokenization built into the game mechanics. I think a lot of people who don't speak to game developers or haven't had experience talking and working with game developers probably don't realize the complexity of layering tokens and NFTs on top of game economics in the constrained world. Those people will be used to playing games with fixed rules that exist within this kind of closed box where there is a defined progression and you achieve certain characteristics or you achieve certain levels, and that path is very clearly defined. And that's all within the control of the game developer. When you then start getting to game tokens and assets and cryptocurrencies and NFTs, the popularity of those things, the use of them, you can control the power or the effect they have, but you cannot control the price or the drop rate relative to the excitement of the game. We saw this with Axie Infinity, it actually started becoming, because of the crypto economics, a viable alternative to other minimum wage in certain parts of the world. And so you'd have people playing video games on smartphones to win crypto and NFTs because that was more value or more dollars per hour than doing whatever equivalent role they could be doing locally. Tell me a single game developer that thought suddenly half of the Philippines would be playing their video game instead of going to work. These are things that game economists can't control. And so the idea of subnets, the idea to have a little bit more of control around your blockchain, how your tokens behave and what they can and can't do, I think is probably helpful training wheels. I think we know that the general direction of travel will be public and permissionless. But like your experience, I think, with financial services is that people start with subnets or people start with private networks because the fear of having public chain, public tokens, everything open to everybody all the time, is there's a huge amount of benefit in that story. But I think there's also a huge amount of risk. And traditional Web2 raised traditional capitalists look at Web3 and think, oh my God, that's really scary. Yeah. I'm not sure if we're ready for this. And once we launch, there's no going back.
Totally. And I think that's why, so just jumping over to say institutional finance. So last year at the Singapore FinTech Festival, there were two pretty large announcements, one with JPM, one with Citi. And both of those were these proof of concepts around a request for pricing, a model where you're doing sales trading and matching across different teams or different entities. And the second one was around digitizing funds and offering them in a fully digital blockchain world, but it's all closed off, right? Meaning you can close it off at the subnet level, they're full KYC, AML, and you can choose who gets to participate and you can evaluate the participants, which is completely the opposite from what most of the gaming companies are trying to do. And so it just shows the range of what's possible to be able to meet the use case in that world, because the public stuff, it is super cool and it is a little scary, but it's the risk of, hey, what are people going to do with it? What is it going to become? That is the part that makes it really interesting. And you see that, and we're counting on that. We're counting on people to think about the things that we didn't think about and drive the industry forward in a way that actually the users want. And in the financial world, it's a lot less like that, right? You don't want people driving the narrative around regulated currencies and regulated activities. And so you can get the best of both worlds. And I think you're seeing that between the two. And then jump over to a different use case for, it's more enterprise in South Korea, the conglomerate SK Planet. So they did something that I thought was very unique too, which is all their users are KYC'd as part of using their kind of super app. And they basically just hooked in a Web3 component that has to do with NFT and loyalty pricing on the back of a mobile app that already existed. And so all of a sudden, they're starting to improve engagement around offering this enhanced loyalty program through these kind of dynamic membership benefits, like you mentioned, leveling up and things like that, which increase spending, which creates new revenue streams for them. But that's an interesting one too, because it's also KYC'd, but it's hooked onto a Web2 application and just merging the two together. I think a lot of people call it Web2.5. And so you're seeing the flexibility of saying something fully public and really crypto native and really wild doing its own thing. And then you see the kind of strict structures of the regulated financial world. And then you see these things in the middle, which are these Web 2.5 implementations of existing, it's an add-on to an existing program or an existing product.
I think the Web 2.5 story is interesting because the experience or the user experience or the loyalty experience that a lot of companies want their users to have is go to the website, log in with your email, interact with my stuff. But the benefit that they're looking to integrate is we'd like to create tokens, we'd like to create NFTs, we'd like to create vouchers, whatever it might be, that others can interact with, that others can program with. If there is an SK token that's worth X number of dollars, we can allow that to be accepted with any one of our partners anywhere in the world. That doesn't have to be something that sits on our CRM that has to go through our financial settlement in South Korea when actually we want to engage an audience in the US or we want to engage an audience in Africa. And so that interconnected borderless commerce or that interconnected interoperability becomes super interesting. You've also got zero person data and the emergence of the idea of bring your own cookies. And so this is one that when I give the example, I usually reference airlines and airline miles at the moment. It's not something I've ever done personally, but I have been reliably informed by people who travel more than I do that if you have gold status or senator status or God tier or whatever it is on whichever airline you fly, you can go to another airline and create some sort of OTC deal where you say to them, hey, I'm gold status. I'll probably fly more on your airline if you give me gold status with you. Are you prepared to do that? And they will. Imagine the complexity of how that gets negotiated. There's no workflow for that on the web at the moment. There's probably a bunch of premium business class sales and contact center people who have to send emails back and forth, and it all becomes very complicated. Just to acknowledge that somebody has a status or that somebody is a customer that you would like to retain or to attract. With tokenization and the ability to have tokens that are standardized, universally recognizable and integratable into other commerce systems, I can bring my air miles with me. I can bring my status with me. I can bring my proof of my training, proof of my wins in a certain gaming environment, my proof of crypto holdings, if people are interested in whales and net worth. These are simplistic examples. The reality is it'll be more nuanced than this. But this is the bring your own side of commerce, that without tokenization or without a layer of interoperability is very hard to deliver and would oftentimes require physical technical integrations between one company and another, which would make the ability to do that unfeasible. And so when you talk about loyalty, when you talk about the idea of tokenization, this is where I get really excited, because you can start seeing the possibility, the potential that companies are just starting to tinker with, right? The Lamborghinis, the Volkswagens of the world starting to have a little bit of a play, the SKs as well. The banks are starting to have a little bit of a play with decentralized or at least distributed networks, but they can't turn the public permissionless taps on yet because of regulation, because of crypto and so on. But you can see those moves. They know they can see the value case, I think, or somebody's Absolutely. Written it at least.
Yeah. There's all that stuff, the status matching that you talked about between airlines, and it's a very inefficient process right now. And this idea of that, the idea of self-custody and the self-custody of your identity and self-custody of your own purchases and your assets and all that stuff that can travel with you. I know Twitter influencers who are not happy that Twitter owns all their content, and they put a lot of time and effort into putting that content out. And so you're starting to see the advent of these social dApps that are launching that where you get ownership of your own content, and you can create some interesting tokenomics around how people are rewarded for following, and you can follow somebody early and they grow and you share in their growth and things like that. There's actually, so Asia Pacific in my mind is just leading completely because their governments have provided a pretty clear framework that says this is inbounds and this is out of bounds. And maybe some of this area we're not quite sure about yet, but we'll figure it out and we'll let you know. We'll give that some time. But here's where you can play. Here are some sandboxes. And the Monetary Authority in Singapore has launched two projects, Guardian and Orchid, and one's around enterprises and one's around financial institutions. And we've been participating in both those because we love the fact that there's clarity on what it can do. And then nobody's scared to come in to the sandbox because nobody's outside the lines. There's another loyalty points program that's been announced but not launched, launching in this quarter, towards the end of this quarter in Japan. It's the largest loyalty points program called Ponta, and it's part of loyalty marketing. And what's interesting about that one is they're very, if you think about the loyalty points, especially in Asia, where it's such a massive part of everybody's daily lives, the interesting thing here is there's these operational efficiencies that happen because they need to connect their system to 280,000 merchants. And this is the classic crux of traditional Web2 systems is that I can build mine in one way and your system of accounting might be a different way. And somehow we need to get those to meet in the middle and settle and not have quote unquote trade breaks, right? Coming from like my previous world. And so blockchains really just take out that trade break, that having multiple ledgers that need to true up that problem. And so when you get in and you have these true digital systems that are peer-to-peer, whether they be fully decentralized or decentralized in a controlled way, then connecting your point system to a new merchant becomes dramatically easier because you're just using one standard set of operations with one standard set of accounting rules. And so they are, you know, it's very smart for them. They're seeing the opportunity to really bring down their operations costs by being able to onboard merchants more quickly. And then from the user point of view, I think they have something like 118 million users. It's massive. And and they're going to create a secondary market, just like you said. So you accrue all these points, and maybe these points, with these points, you get something that you don't use very often. Let's say tickets to a baseball game. You're not a baseball fan. And so there's this, you'll be able to drop them onto a secondary marketplace and be able to pay those out. And it'll all just be with the points program. You're not having to pay in fiat or anything else. You're just exchanging points for goods. And so it creates this whole nother marketplace that it's empowering the users as well to have these like really nice, clean rails of exchange where they didn't have them before.
I really like the example of loyalty. And as I was thinking of that, I was thinking of the poor payment processors and the role that they currently provide in these ecosystems as the intermediary, as the standards provider, as the 1-2% charges for being able to just shuttle payments back and forth. And back in the day, very many years ago, I was involved in trying to build a merchant loyalty and offers proposition from one such payments producer. And the reason they could do it is because they were in the middle. They had this privileged position of shuttling payments between different member banks, and they had X number of merchants. And so the merchants could provide offers and it would be targeted because that particular company also knew your spend. They knew how much you spent on your credit card, on which things. And so the amount of data about you in that particular system is very rich. The challenges with that system was the requirement to get the buy-in from all the different participants, the requirement to get the number of merchants to produce offers. The number of offers required was very significant. So if you look at the number of users, the number of segments, the number of targeted offers for those segments, and so on and so forth, you end up with a something like a 50 by 50 grid that then tells you you need a 50 to the power of 50 number of offers in the system, and you have to manually curate those or encourage merchants to manually curate those, and eventually the user experience and the technical complexity of it just wasn't feasible. The idea was correct, but it was technically unfeasible for a single centralized party to deploy. Sounds, I want to say 10 years later, we now have a better technology, a better architecture, and a more likely route to success that also the party in the middle isn't creaming off 1-3% of the transactions. And more of that money can be going either towards technology delivery or towards funding offers or towards supporting liquidity or whatever else it might be that system needs. The settlement doesn't become a problem. The incentivization doesn't become a problem. The fees don't become a problem. You can work and spend on more of the value add stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the cost efficiencies of just running in a true digital and only digital environment will be there. And then you bring up an interesting point, which is these are typically data businesses. And the traditional thinking around kind of crypto and the blockchain mentality is, you know, control, self-sovereign identity. But I think that what the truth is there's somewhere in the middle where you're going to have totally the option. I mean, there's going to be so much identity protection technology that just comes along with crypto, and it leans itself to that as a whole. But there's the other side too, which wallets and NFTs and all these assets, they can be tracked on chain, and enterprise and the user is willing to allow them to do that. The enterprises can use them to collect data and then make decisions on that data. That industry, that is the primary industry of our modern time. It's not going away anytime soon. And there's this kind of, sometimes there's thinking of, oh, it's opposite of that, or it's against that. And I don't think it's against that. It just wants the ability to not participate in that if it doesn't want to, but can also very much support it in places where people are wanting to participate.
There's a middle ground, right? It's having a large party like a Google or a Facebook or whoever else it is have huge reams of very sensitive data about you, and the power to monetize that data and advertise to you is not a particularly comforting thought to many. At the same time, and one of the barriers to enterprise adoption for blockchains for the longest time has been having all of your token data, your crypto data visible on a public blockchain all of the time. So you've got this kind of metadata challenge with public chains, which is also a challenge, the centralization problem, which is also a challenge. You can try to address something like that with subnets and say, actually, we'll create a hybrid chain where some of the data will be visible, some of it won't. Some of it will be broadcast to everybody, some of it will remain private. Or maybe you create different behavior with some of the tokens. This is a problem that's uniquely interesting and uniquely intimate to me, because the project I work with at the moment, Midnight, is focused specifically on data protection. So use of zero knowledge to protect as much personal data as possible, using proofs instead of sending sensitive data, using smart contracts that consume proofs as opposed to passing sensitive data over the internet, and so on. It's not a model that works for everything all of the time, but it's exciting because we're now at this point where we don't have to worry about the infrastructure anymore. The infrastructure is decentralized. It is robust. The smart contracts work. The programming languages are there. With AvaCloud and others, we now have software or blockchain as a service that can allow us to do less of the configuration up front. What I think the next challenge we have is helping the developers of applications, the developers of the incentive structures for games, for loyalty programs, etc., understand how to make use of the tools that we have. Because I think we don't need more infrastructure now. Yeah. We may need a little bit more as a service. I nearly said we might need a bit more ass. We need a little bit more as a service to enable others to consume it easy and simply. But I also think some of the application developers or some of the architects of these applications and systems or programs, they probably don't have a grounding in Web3 or tokenomics or game theory or the flywheel effect of creating open and decentralized networks. And that's the last bit. But we're so nearly there. I don't know if you feel it, but I feel that we are very close.
Oh, definitely. That's in our roadmap, right? We need to be good at what we're doing now, which is the base infrastructure and launching subnets as a managed service. But there's the Ava Studios team is there, and they're all founders and builders, and they're experts in tokenomics. And so every single client is a conversation, and some of them come to us and say, we got it all figured out. We don't really need to talk to you. And some come to us and say, we have a lot of questions in what are best practices from your experience? And so that team is very hands-on in providing this white glove experience. And then from the product point of view, we're getting to the point where we're starting to fill that application layer. And so the goal for us is basically to take these very common code structures, let's just say the launching of an NFT or minting NFT or minting NFTs with certain characteristics or secondary marketplaces with NFTs, and then just creating, you know, very standard APIs that you can go and use to build your own. And so you're just having to use maybe a little bit of glue code to do most of the development around the things we know people want. And then you're taking your novel idea, and that's where you have to dig in and carve your own path. But that's very much the path we're on. And that's very much the integrations side of the AvaCloud product, which is trying to get credit card processing and verifiable randomness on chain and all the things that you might need for these various components that exist there for them to use. And then they can just build on top of it.
And then eventually over time, the white glove type experience or the guided sale kind of melts away because you've enabled more functionality, more self-serve, or there are more middleware providers or integrators who can take some of what you have and build their own stack on top, right? Imagining a zero knowledge Salesforce or an AvaCloud subnet version of SAP or whatever else it might be, the networks that we have for clearing and settlement between banks, whatever it might be, whoever's building that stack, AvaCloud or other blockchains just get plugged into that overall package. And you're not worrying about saying, we want a blockchain anymore. You're saying, we've got a complete suite of applications and workflows that includes tokenization. And it has all the token standards you want. And it's payable as a service in fiat currency. And you can consume it like you're used to consuming things. That's when we know we've made it, because like very many people say, when people don't realize the blockchain's underneath it anymore, we've probably done a good job, but the economics or the experience or the functionality that we've enabled is being used, felt, and people are benefiting from it.
Exactly. That's the dream. That's the progression we're on. It's very much, and so I think it's revolutionary. I'm super excited about it. Is platform as a service, blockchain as a service, is that sexy stuff? Probably not. But what it enables is like this explosion of ideas, that because the barriers to get those ideas and prove those ideas is now been completely reduced. And that's the aspect of it that really excites me about it, is that when that initial thing, when we launched subnets and we're like, all right, here it goes. And then it didn't really explode the way we expected it to. Now we're starting to see that where it's like, oh, I can launch this thing in a minute. Like all this stuff that would have taken months before is literally just infrastructure as code now. And that's a big testament to such a talented engineering team at Ava Labs, but it's really starting to make it much easier kind of to prove and to test new ideas without such heavy cost and time burdens.
I'm going to ask you one quick question then when we'll get into the Q&A, because I can see the questions are mounting up here and there's a couple that I definitely want to get to. But one that we did talk about before the show, and I'd love to hear your perspective on, because I think these are things that are interesting to anybody who works in and around blockchain. What are some of the common misconceptions, or give me one or two examples of the things that you hear from enterprises or clients that you get to speak to about AvaCloud or about blockchain applications, decentralized apps? What are some of the misconceptions that people come back to you with and you think, seriously, in 2024, we're still doing this? What are some fun examples, or what are the ones that you hear most often?
Yeah, so the ones I deal with the most that are just, it's just cost and time, right? Cost, time, and risk are really the big three things. It's like this triangle that we're trying to solve for, which is cost we've dealt with. Like it's as affordable to launch your own custom blockchain now as it is to launch your own website. Like that's just settled for. And we have something called the founders tier. And it's just, it's amazing how we've been able to create efficiencies to be able to offer that out to the developers so they can get out. Time, same thing. It's like literally if you go into avacloud.io, you launch a free devnet, you'll see it takes about 30 seconds to launch your own custom blockchain at this point. It's literally laser quick. And then as you move up into testnet and especially mainnet, where admin keys and validators and the minting, not that stuff is a much larger process. But in sandbox, it's extremely fast. And most of the stuff that takes longer is really just us being sure that we're not allowing people. It's like almost like a seatbelt rule of sorts, where you just want to make sure that there's obvious things we're doing to protect each other. outside of that, just the association with it really was a hard pill to swallow with the FTX stuff and the fact that these centralized exchanges that really had very little to do with blockchain and crypto were being so heavily associated with the underlying technology that's actually moving away from what those institutions embodied. And so that was a really, and nobody, you like, the more you talked about it, it's just like, crypto is a scam. That narrative destroys me because there's so many great use cases. And the more we do with Citibanks and the JPMs and the SKs and the Deloittes of the world, that the more we can start to really show that there are very powerful real world use cases that ultimately start to provide benefits for the users and create cost savings and functionality opportunities that these large enterprises didn't have before. And so that's what we need more of and less of the hack or the scam, or because it's all there and it's, and the technology supports, it's just a tool, right? It's going to enable everything that it enables, and you either choose to go down a bad actor path or there's all this really cool stuff you can do that's not a bad actor path. And so that's what I evangelize is, like, yes, that stuff exists, but so does the dark web.
And yeah, it's not like bad stuff doesn't happen on the regular internet too. It's just, it's become normalized now, and we've gone far enough down the road that we've got enough good use cases and good examples to stay positive. Speaking of which, we've got a couple of minutes if we can still go for the next couple. There are a couple of questions. Liam, I see you in the comment section as well. Shout out, Liam. But I have a question here from Carolyn. Carolyn, how are you doing? What makes you most optimistic about blockchain adoption for businesses or enterprises? What's the thing that you hold on to the most that makes you most optimistic?
You have to consider your audiences on both sides, but it's really complementary. And so on the enterprise side or the builder side, the business side, you have two things, which is you have the ability to drive massive cost optimization, which I think a lot of companies care about, right? When you go to justify why would we do this, you need to be able to show that you're not doing something that's going to be super expensive. The second piece is it just unlocks the type of functionality in a lot of ways that didn't exist before, in ways where something that maybe took like a lot of clicking and manual passing from one person to another, like the Deloitte FEMA use case is a great one for that, get simplified down. So things like, in that case, disaster recovery funds, getting to the municipality that needs them, who's in this point of suffering, it happens much faster because there's a new technology that's basically linking all these previously disparate data sources together in a very clean way. And for the end user, I think it's endless. There's just so much cool stuff you can do, and we haven't even popped the lid off of that one yet. It's going to be, people are going to find really neat things to do that are going to like make decisions based on events that are happening with large scale data. And then I hear people trickling AI on top of that, and you get this hype potion, but I think there's going to be some real, very real stuff that comes out of it.
Love that. Yeah, the intersection of blockchain and AI is one that we won't cover in the rest of the time we have on the show, but it's certainly one that's got lots of potential. The best version of being optimistic, or the way to frame optimism for the future of blockchain for me, is one that actually on the show prior to this with Charles Hoskinson, we talked about a little bit, which is, if you look forward to 2030, do you see a world that has more or less data and digital processes in it? Do you see a world where people are more or less trusting of enterprises and third parties? Probably less trusting. Do you see a world where you have more or less automation of activity and connectivity between multiple parties? And in a world like that, do you want to see more automation, more trust, less cost, and less reliance on an intermediary of some kind to allow the systems to work? We talked about examples in finance. We talked about examples in loyalty. At the moment, we have a not particularly efficient system for a bunch of those things. And it's only going to get, I don't say worse, but it's only going to get more intense in all the dimensions that today we're struggling with. And then layer on top of that, maybe also, do you feel that people are going to want more or less control over their own data? And so then gives me lots of reasons for optimism, at least.
Totally. And I think it's just about getting a balance in place in a lot of these use cases where the consumer should have the ability to outright say what gets exposed, what data they want to give. So if we're dealing with points programs, and they should be able to know and own the data that's being collected and then be able to expose it for some kind of reciprocity if that's what they choose to do. So I think when you get into it, like, I really see the future being a more level playing field. And I think that's the original intent of the technology itself, which was like, it's a backlash reaction to not having control over certain sovereign parts of your life or your digital life that you should. And so it was basically like, all right, we technologically can figure this out as a way to circumvent a lot of these things. And I think what you're getting is, okay, let's come to the table and find something where both parties are playing well and we're not outside of the legal bounds of where we should be. And so I just see it advancing in that direction where I hope the level of empowerment to the individual keeps growing. And I think that's one of the primary things it achieves to do.
And that's what we're out here doing, right? Is we're trying to build technology and solutions that makes it easier for other people to enable that for whatever applications they build in whatever industry and whatever geography. Nick, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time. We didn't get through all the questions, but some of them are in the chat. So if you want to jump back in there after the show, you're very welcome to go in and come back to some guys that asked some questions around ERC4337. There's a question in there about how you construct your product teams. What's your operating model for how you and the Ava Labs team actually go about product innovation, which would be a lovely conversation that I wish we had more time for. But we are at time, so that's all for today. Thank you, everybody, for listening in. Thank you, everybody, for the comments and questions. Nick, thank you for giving us a little bit of an insight into your world, into Ava Cloud, Ava Labs, and Avalanche in general. Have a great rest of your day and stay safe out there.
Great. Thanks, Anthony. Real pleasure.
Thanks again for listening to the Blockchain Won't Save the World podcast. As always, opinions in this episode are mine and those of my guests alone. If you want to find out more, please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. Check out some of the other episodes on the Blockchain Won't Save the World podcast and check out the YouTube channel, also called Blockchain Won't Save the World. Stay safe out there.